wonderful to be back. I'll be giving a, as you probably know, I'll be giving a colloquium later today on the wonders of the LHC. For this talk, I'm going to be talking about ultimately things that are motivated by, in the end, really motivated by ultimately cosmology. So, as you all know, in the past 5 years or so, there's been a relatively startling realization that maybe even our best candidate for a unique underlying theory of the world might not, even though it might be a unique theoretical structure, might not nonetheless give rise to a unique long-distance theory, and might instead give us zillions and zillions, or tens of the zillions, of different possible long-distance theories. And this has given rise to a lot of hand-wringing and polemics. But in fact, there are even people who say that these set of ideas must just be, they're completely, totally unpredictive. Anything goes. There's 10 to the 500 different worlds. Surely there's one of them in which we have unicorns and we have any crazy thing you might imagine. But there's lots and lots of indications that that's not actually true, and that even though there doesn't seem to be a unique long-distance structure, nonetheless, there are some definite regularities. And there might even be some heretofore unexpected rules or laws that are general facts about what any consistent theory of gravity should look like, which were unsuspected, and which end up putting constraints on what the long-distance, low-energy world can look like. So, in other words, there are theories that you might have suspected were completely consistent from a long-distance point of view, and yet can't be realized, first of all, empirically, can't be realized, theoretically, empirically, can't be realized by anyone attempting to embed these theories into a microscopic theory like string theory. But more to the point, there might even be good reasons why they can't be realized, and there might be fundamental reasons they can't be realized. And so it's good to know what those rules are, and it's especially surprising if they apply to a long-distance effective field theories that otherwise seem perfectly consistent. So that's what I want to talk about some today. I've been thinking about this subject off and on for a couple of years now, and I don't want to go, I want to briefly touch on some of the early examples of this that we found, and then tell you about some very much sharper recent examples of things along these lines. One based on a recent paper with Joe Polchinski and his student Jacopo Ruggiero, and another one based on some ideas in progress. But actually, in order to motivate this, instead of from this very abstract considerations, I just want to give you an example of a theory which we might even like to realize, and which we might even be forced to realize, depending on whether we see gravity waves from at Planck, which is theories that naturally give us observable gravity waves. Okay. Observable. So can we get observable gravity waves from inflation? So I want to start from a theory, and then we'll see how it relates to these ideas. All right. Well, actually, the very, very simplest possible theory of inflation. So let me back up. Seeing observable gravity waves from inflation would immediately tell us that we're probing Planck scale physics in a certain sense. And it's in the following sense. If you believe in slow roll inflation, then the rate at which then phi dot is v prime over h, leaving out all factors, okay? So I have some potential. Phi dot is v prime over h. So v phi, the change in phi per e folding, dn, so this is 1 over h d phi dt, this is v prime over h squared. This is h squared is v over m Planck, so v over m Planck squared, so this is This is m Planck squared v prime over v, which I can rewrite then as d dn of phi over m Planck. The change in phi over m Planck is around m Planck v prime over v, which is one of the slow roll parameters. It's root epsilon. So if I just naively integrate this equation, I get that the change of phi in Planck units is around the number of e-foldings times root epsilon. Okay? So the number of e-foldings is bounded beneath by, let's call it around 60. And also, epsilon is precisely the ratio of the power in scalar modes to tensor modes. So tensor modes are suppressed relative to the scalar modes by precisely this factor of the epsilon. Okay. So for Planck to see gravity waves, just as an experimental fact, epsilon has got to be bigger than about 10 to the minus 2 or so. Okay. So if you shove it into this formula, if Planck sees gravity waves, then the infoton has changed in Planck units by an amount of order 60 times a tenth or so. Let's, when you do it a little more properly, it's about 4. So please don't. So that's not very approximately. Okay? I can do arithmetic a little better than that. All right? Anyway, so that's an interesting statement. If Planck sees gravity waves, and if we believe in any picture of slow roll inflation, then the inflaton will have traversed many Planck units. And here, Planck doesn't mean some garden variety high energy scale. You can't replace it by the string scale or the gut scale. It actually means the actual Planck scale. It's actually gravity. It's actually M Planck. Okay? All right. Now, now, a long time ago, and still, there are a number of silly arguments. So the story is going to be very slightly subtle because I'm going to tell you that there were some arguments that this should be impossible. I'm going to tell you those arguments were silly. I'm going to tell you a more sophisticated argument that everything is fine. And nonetheless, I'm going to say again in the end that there's something funny about this. Okay? But I first want to tell you what the first set of things that people said. Well, the first thing people said is, this doesn't make any sense because we have a variation on scales larger than the Planck scale, surely there are higher dimension operators that I don't know what's going on. There are terms like this. And so I just can't trust this whole calculation. Okay? And this is just nonsense. This is nonsense because you can say it from a variety of points of view. One of them is that, let's see why it's nonsense by writing down the simplest consistent theory of inflation. The fact that this the theory is so easy to write down should give pause to people building complicated models of inflation. Okay, so let's just say there's a theory of the shift symmetry on some scalar field, and it's broken by a small mass term. Okay, so this is André Linde's first theory of inflation, m squared phi squared. Now, there are, of course, necessarily corrections to this. There are necessarily corrections to this. There's higher terms here which are just generated under the renormalization group by gravity. Okay. So, for instance, there is a diagram like this, and it generates a phi to the fourth term, and I can compute it. There's a logarithm there, it's running, there's nothing I can do to fine-tune it away, it's just a calculable effect. But it's also tiny. Okay. This is something which generates a phi to the fourth term of order m squared over m Planck squared squared. Okay. Phi to the fourth, there's a log here, okay, but I can keep going. And these effects are absolutely minuscule. In other words, the same thing that explains why the inflaton potential is flat to begin with will explain why none of these higher order terms are there. Okay?
Is the saying and you have to assume it once.
That's right. That's right. And this is, of course, precisely equivalent to what Linde has been saying about this theory the whole time, which is that at energies, at field excursions of order M Planck, the energy density of the inflaton is tiny compared to the Planck scale. There's no reason for there to be huge corrections. And so that's it.
An interesting bit of history. Yes. About 6 months after he wrote the paper on this chaotic inflation, there was a paper by Enquist and Malalampi, presumably making this claim in written form. And he actually wrote a rebuttal to it.
Yes.
Basically doing this argument with you know, explicit calculation of graviton correction.
Right.
And actually, an interesting bit is, you know who calculated the theoretically in the written form this first?
No.
Lee Small.
Oh, really?
It's interesting.
No comment. All right. Very good. So there's nothing wrong from effective long distance theory point of view. Absolutely nothing wrong to have this m squared phi squared theory of inflation or any other one that would give you a delta phi of order m Planck. Okay. Now, in fact, there are even nice proposals for what such a theory might be. For example, if you have any kind of periodic scalar field, could be an axion, anything, okay? Then let's imagine writing down its effect of Lagrangian. So we would normally have some decay constant f, and maybe it has some potential. There's some scale here. It doesn't even matter what it is. It's very reasonable for the leading potential to be some periodic function. Obviously, if we expand this around the minimum, this just turns into m squared phi squared inflation. And once again, it doesn't even matter what the scale lambda is. This inflates and gives us gravity waves, allows big excursions, when f is much larger than the Planck scale m Planck. Okay? So this is an example of a theory like this. And here, too, you might be tempted to say, but I can't do this. I can't have a symmetry-breaking scale much larger than the Planck scale. It doesn't make any sense. And once again, there's nothing wrong from a long-distance theory point of view. For example, here's an entirely trivial, dumb observation that was made in a paper. It's so trivial, it hardly needed to be said, but it was made in a paper that I wrote with Lisa Randall and Cynthia.
Yeah.
You were on that paper, right, Cynthia?
Yeah.
Yes. And Paolo Carminelli. So if we have them,
someone turn it off, please.
Yuri, mute yourself.
Turn our volume off.
Or turn our volume down.
That's all right.
Is that okay? Okay. So if we have a gauge theory in five dimensions, okay? If we have a gauge theory in five dimensions, let's say just a U1 gauge theory in five dimensions. So if we have an action that looks like this, and I have some five-dimensional Planck scale. And if I compactify this on a circle, then there is a scalar field, which is the natural periodic scalar field here. It's just the winding mode around the circle. So theta, which is A5R. Okay. And it's very easy to see that I can clearly make the kinetic term for this guy as big as I want by making the five-dimensional gauge coupling as small as I want. Okay. So in the limit, as I make G5 in Planck units, very, very tiny, I can make the effective low-dimensional f as big as I want compared to m Planck. Okay? So here's a very concrete realization. The circle is big. Everything is under control. Planckian corrections are under control as far as effective field theory is concerned. Everything seems perfectly fine. All I have to do is make a U1 coupling weak. Oh, gosh, that's just making the theory more and more weakly coupled. What could possibly be wrong with that? Okay. So here's a concrete example of a theory. You might, and again, we might even want it, right? This theory very trivially explains inflation and gives us gravity waves. Okay. All right, so these theories are perfectly fine from the effective theory point of view. Okay, but then something interesting started happening. This is such a simple idea. People started trying to realize it in string theory. And that's where the trouble began, okay? Because it seemed like every single time you could start getting F close to M Planck, something happened that invalidated the long distance conclusion. Some object became light. Some winding mode became light. Some Rath brain became light. Or you could make F much larger than M Planck, but some instanton corrections ended up being a lot bigger than you expected, so that the effective actual F got normalized down and became comparable to the Planck scale again. Okay. So I'll come back to this in a second. But there definitely seemed to be some tension. It's such a simple limit, you would think that you could parametrically realize this limit somehow. There's definitely some tension with getting to this limit. Another example of so people tried to take exactly the same idea, and the Stanford group said, okay, well, maybe I can't get a given one F. Maybe I can't get one F much larger than M Planck. Maybe at best I can get one F comparable to M Planck. Okay? Or maybe even comparable to M string, which is even more typical to what might happen. And the string scale is typically beneath the Planck scale. But that's no big deal, because string theory has lots and lots of axions. So I really have a sum over I Fi squared d theta I squared. Okay? And therefore, there's the diagonal mode where all the thetas are equal to each other. There's n of them. And for that diagonal mode, effectively, let's say all these f's were the same. I have an n f squared d theta squared. Okay, so by this trick, I can jack up n. By this trick, I can jack up the actual effective f squared, and thereby get a theory that inflates and gives me gravity waves. Okay? And that also seems like a great idea that can be maybe even, so you just go to parametrically huge n, and you can inflate as much as you want, get an F as much as you want above the Planck scale. But this also does not work. This idea does not work parametrically. Because when you have so many light fields in any theory, there is a huge renormalization of the Newton constant. Okay? With the n fields running around in a loop, if there's any kind of ultraviolet cutoff lambda on the theory, there's a renormalization of the Planck scale that's proportional to n in units of the cutoff. So as you jack up more and more species, the Planck scale inevitably gets larger and larger. See, in precisely such a way as to undo this effect. Because f squared should be bounded by the fundamental cutoff of the theory squared in all of these examples. And so you see at large n, I'll get n cutoff squared sitting in front of d theta squared, and n cutoff squared sitting in front of root gr. So the actual f squared and the actual m Planck squared are comparable to each other again. Okay. But this points out something else that you think you can do in effective field. So here is, in this example, here's something that seems totally reasonable to do in effective field theory. Make a coupling arbitrarily weak. Okay. Here I'm pointing out something else. Maybe this might seem a little less reasonable to do in effective field theory because it would require fine-tuning. But still, there's nothing in principle wrong with jacking up the number of light species and maybe fine-tuning to keep the Planck scale fixed as I make the number of species bigger and bigger. All it is fine-tuning. Okay? And gosh, by now, you know, 10 to the minus 120 is nothing. So, you know, a little 10 to the 10 here or there is like nothing for landscape friends to argue about. Okay? So here are two different things that here it looks like you could realize this if you did some tuning. Okay? But these are two different things that it seems like you can definitely do in effective field theory. And what I'm going to say is that there's already some evidence, I think some pretty good evidence, that there are impossibilities associated with both of these things. And then I'm going to sharpen these statements to at least some statements where I can definitely prove that things are impossible. But I just want to motivate, it's not some egghead question. I mean, it's really related to the question of whether or not we'll see gravity waves. And if we see them, how surprised should we be? I think the bottom line is going to be, if we see them, I will eat my hat. Okay, I will be really, really surprised. And I think it would really force a bit of a crisis It's fascinating that seeing gravity waves is really pushing right up against something that it sure appears quantum gravity does not want to do. OK? Okay, it certainly does not naturally do it. And I can't, by the end of the talk, I won't be able to definitively prove that we won't see it. But there will be many results pointing in that direction. So I think if we see gravity waves, it will be a small earthquake, at least for my own thinking. Okay. Actually, this example is fairly famous. It goes all the way back to Bekenstein in the 70s and 80s, and it's the famous species bound. Okay? That Bekenstein argued that you can't have a huge number of species because it would renormalize black hole entropy to become much larger than the area of a black hole in G Newton units. And so you can see how that works, right? If we crank up the number of species and we keep the Planck scale fixed, let's say I have a black hole that's sitting there, well, just the entropy in the Hawking radiation of the particles outside, there's n species, n is big, I can make that correction to the entropy as large as I want, okay? And it can violate the idea that the entropy should be bounded by the area in Newton constant. And you also see how a reasonable theory won't let that happen for this reason. As the Planck scale gets large, G Newton gets weak in precisely such a way that the ratio works out nicely. Okay?
So yeah. Since you mentioned it, can you just comment, what do you think of that species bound?
I'm going to prove it in some cases.
Okay.
Yeah.
But on the face of it, from the 70s and 80s.
Right.
Was that convincing already then?
No, so I mean, it's one of those things that...
Maybe we've got to learn that that's
exactly
what entropy is.
Right, and maybe, exactly. But
you're
going to
get into it.
I'm going to get into it more detail. I'm going to prove versions of it.
Okay.
And you'll see precisely what it's related to, and that it's related to unitarity. It's related to exact. But I want to say all the arguments about why these things shouldn't be realizable all have to do with restrictions on the structure of low energy effective field theory following from the existence of black holes. And the consistency of the thermodynamic interpretation of black holes. And it's not surprising, I should say, it's not surprising that that should give you restrictions on what a long-distance theory can look like. Because, you know, this is by now almost a cliche, it's said very often, but our usual idea that short distances shouldn't affect long distances so much is because, you know, short distances decouple, and furthermore, we don't even know what's going on in short distances. It could be, you know, we have no idea what is at short distances, and it better decouple, right. But we just know that that's not true in gravity. Because we know that very, very, very massive objects in gravity are very, very large black holes. Okay, so we know something about the very, very high energy states already. And we know that, in fact, they become more and more infrared objects. Okay? So it's not crazy that there should be some restriction on the long-distance theory that follows from the quantum mechanical consistency of those objects. All right, so that was the species bound. Here, what could be wrong here? Well, what could be wrong here is you say that there's nothing wrong with making the coupling weaker and weaker, just making the theory better and better behaved, but, you know, something starts feeling wrong because there's a limit where I take this coupling and I make it arbitrarily tiny. In fact, there's a limit where the coupling goes exactly to zero, and on that limit, there's no more a gauge symmetry. I have just a global symmetry. But there's this old lore that quantum mechanics and gravity... the black holes violate all global symmetries. Quantum gravity does not have any global symmetries. Okay. So that should make you wary of theories with incredibly weak gauge couplings. When the couplings become incredibly weak, they become undistinguishable from global symmetries. If there's something wrong with global symmetries, there should be something wrong with incredibly small gauge couplings as well. And this actually led us to a conjecture almost 2 years ago called the weak gravity conjecture. That in fact, in any theory, as you make the coupling constant smaller and smaller, that there's, I'll give you the loose form of the conjecture first, that the cutoff, that there's some cutoff where the theory breaks down, which also gets smaller and smaller. Okay? So there's a universe, for example, in four dimensions, there's a cutoff of order g times m Planck. Okay? So as you make, for a fixed m Planck, so it's a gravitational statement. If we send m Planck to infinity, there's no statement. But for a fixed m Planck, as I make g smaller and smaller, some new physics is coming in at lower and lower scales, and the theory is breaking down earlier and earlier. And this is a pretty shocking statement from the point of view of effective field theory. Why on earth should there be something new happening at this very, very low scale? So I don't want to spend the seminar talking about that, we gave arguments basically sharpening the old conjectures about gravity breaking all global symmetries. I should say, what's special about this mass scale is this is the mass of an object where the gravitational attraction between an object of this mass is just equal to the electric repulsion. Okay? So that's why it turns into the statement that gravity is the weakest force. Because it's the statement that there's always a particle that's lighter, a charged particle that's lighter than this amount, for which gravity is repulsive. Okay? And ultimately, this is related to the statement that very large black holes, extremal black holes, had better be able to decay to constituents. So I don't want to talk about this in more detail, other than to say that this loose statement got turned into a very sharp statement that you could actually go check. It was really a completely falsifiable conjecture, and it was quite non-trivially satisfied. And one thing that you can use the string landscape for is data for quantum gravity. Okay, we have zillions of consistent theories. So if you have any conjecture about what quantum gravity should do in general, it's possible to at least falsify it. But this conjecture that we made was not falsified, and it makes a variety of other predictions for signs and higher dimension operators and a whole host of backgrounds, which are quite non-trivially satisfying. So I think there is something. I think this is likely true, but it's still a conjecture. But I just want to then give you a flavor. So what we saw, what's wrong with the other thing, is has something to do with black hole entropy. Okay, what's wrong with this has something to do, again, with global symmetries, black holes. These things can have an effect on the long distance physics. Okay. But now I want to talk about two other things, which, as I said, were a little sharper. If you don't mind, I'm going to tie my shoe. It's driving me crazy. Sorry. So one thing is, let's talk about the first thing. So this subject will at first not appear to be related to the first two things that I said, but you'll see a very direct connection between them shortly. Okay. So I want to talk about Euclidean wormholes and string theory. Okay. This is something else which happens in effective field theory and does something extremely interesting in effective field theory, wormholes in Euclidean gravity, as discussed by Coleman a long time ago. So let me remind you what a wormhole is. If we take Euclidean gravity, wormholes are just saddle points of the action. So, there's a big caveat in any Euclidean quantum gravity that we don't know what we're doing. Okay, but there was an assumption that if you found, at least if you could do something classical physics by finding saddle points of the Euclidean path integral. And then those saddle points should find some physical interpretation. So wormholes were saddle points that connected two different asymptotic regions, two different asymptotic flat space regions to each other, or that connected the same flat, the same surface to itself with arbitrarily separated points. So let's say the points are x and y, wormhole is something that connects points x and y. Now, on the face of it, the wormholes do terrible things. Okay? This wormhole induces some term in the effect of action, which is an integral over the points x and y there in that picture. There are some operators, in this case, and there are some coefficients, which don't depend on x and y at all, hardly. But they can connect arbitrarily separated points on the same space. Okay. So you generate this completely bilocal operator. It looks like a completely destroyed locality. Coleman argued, before saying more about that, one of the motivations I had for thinking about this is that if wormholes make sense, they might have given us some at least indirect way of probing all the other vacuum on the landscape. Because there might have been some way in which the effect of the presence of the other vacua would manifest itself in some way on computations in ours. Okay? In fact, that's precisely how Coleman used these things to solve the cosmological constant problem, as a proposed solution to the cosmological constant problem, by connecting our world to other worlds with ever larger and larger sizes dominated by huge flat bubbles, which effectively set the cosmological constant in our world to zero. Okay? So in fact, the wormhole story is very much a precursor to the landscape story. It seems it has a very similar flavor to it, as we'll discuss. It's not identical, but it has a very, very similar, it has a very similar flavor to it. But it never got settled, and I want to tell you that it's now settled. And that, well, and I'll tell you the direction in which it's settled. But anyway, naively, this looks horrible. But Coleman said, no, this isn't so bad, because this is what I induce in the action. This is some quadratic thing. And I can just rewrite this explicitly as an ordinary integral over some parameters, alpha I, e to the minus alpha I C inverse ij alpha j, e to the minus integral OI of x alpha I. Okay. This is correct, right? If I just do the ordinary integral, I just get the integral of O squared, and that's exactly this very bilocal thing. So he interpreted this by saying, look, this alpha I is just some coupling constant for this operator in the theory. So evidently, the theory isn't unique. There's lots and lots of parameters, and there's a continuous about there's a continuum infinity of values for this parameter, but there's a probability distribution for them. Okay? And so that's just how you're supposed to think about it. Despite the fact that the theory seemed unique, I had a unique vacuum. In fact, there's an infinite number of undetermined parameters that you just have to take from experiment. Okay? But then in any given universe, all these different values decohere, so you don't average over them anymore. So as much as people hate the landscape, wormholes were a much worse version of the same thing. Even in a purportedly completely unique vacuum, there was an infinite number of undetermined parameters, only with a probability distribution, and you just have to go out and measure them.
Is C guaranteed to be non-singular?
In all these semi-classical things, it's really just some numbers. Okay? The OI are just things that have the quantum numbers of the mouth of the wormhole. Okay? And by the way, the wormholes had a very definite effect. The leading effect was to violate all global symmetries. Because, global symmetries could come in this end and reappear in that end. And when you interpret them in this local way, then there's just things, see, OI of X, OJ of Y might have conserved charge. But when you interpret them like this, you have to think of the alphas as things to just explicitly break the global symmetries. So the leading effect of wormholes was to indeed realize this idea that gravity breaks all global symmetries. All right, so that was Coleman's interpretation. And he went on, as I say, there was additional assumptions that went into arguing that these things solve the cosmological constant problem. But I once again want to emphasize that this was a statement about a unique, supposedly unique theory, actually isn't. Okay, secretly has all these totally undetermined parameters. Now, this thinking got a boost about simultaneously by work of Giddings and Strominger that further showed that you could indeed get these wormhole solutions very straightforwardly in theories of gravity coupled to other stuff. Okay? So if you have gravity plus axions, and I'll talk about these solutions a little more in a second, but you just have gravity just plus a single axion, they found one of these wormhole solutions that could be made arbitrarily fat compared to the Planck scale. So a totally trustworthy semi-classical solution, and it was parametrized by an axion flux going through the wormhole throat. So in the limit, as you made the axion flux large, the wormhole was arbitrarily large in Planck units. Okay, so supposedly totally under control semi-classically. And therefore, if you trust long-distance effective field theory, of course, in this case, we don't quite know the rules because it's Euclidean quantum gravity. But if you just do the same thing that works over and over again in other contexts, you're forced into Coleman's interpretation. Okay. So that was the situation in the early 90s. Okay, there are theories, simple, effective theories, that seem to give you wormholes, and therefore this this terrible proliferation of undetermined parameters. Now, of course, especially these authors continued and tried to see if this issue could be made sharper by realizing wormholes in string theory. And then something interesting happened. So in string theory, you don't just have axions. You have axions and dilatons. And they found, and we'll understand a little better why in a second, they found that in that situation, they couldn't find non-singular solutions. They couldn't find smooth solutions that looked like wormholes. And all the examples they had, the solutions became singular before the throat formed and you turned around. Okay. So that was the status in the early 90s. Modulo, a paper that had exactly one citation between 1991 and when Joe and I wrote our paper, that had actually noticed the loophole, by Kambakas. But anyway, that was, if you were to stop a string theorist on the street and any time in this period and say, do wormholes make sense? I think the answer would be, we can't embed them in string theory. And therefore, they do these terrible things. You see, these alpha parameters are an exact moral opposition to the idea of string theory is a unique theory of everything, okay? This just removes the possibility of a unique theory of everything from the get-go. And so I think the idea was that that string theory was smart enough not to produce the kinds of effective field theories that would give you wormholes. Okay, that was the attitude.
Are you able to say briefly what dilatons have to do with
Yes, and I'll say it in I will explain. And part of what we did that allowed us to get beyond this is actually it's very simple, but understand why it was that people couldn't find solutions before. Understand it in a nice sort of geometrical language. That'll then make it clear that there was no fundamental obstacle.
In this construction, there was some sign issue.
Yes, I'll tell you about the sign issue. All right. Now, actually, then in about 2002 or so, Bergschoff and collaborators finally found, and now those papers have more than one citation, they basically rediscovered the Tambakas trick, and they found wormhole solutions in four dimensions, okay, in four flat dimensions. So compactifications of string theory in four dimensions. That might sound great because four dimensions is our world, at least part of our world. But actually, from our point of view, it's not great because what we'd like to do is not just find wormholes in string theory, but embed them in theories we understand completely, which are ADS theories. Okay. So if we can embed wormholes in ADS CFT, then we can really start talking about them. And you can't do that with four flat dimensions. With four flat dimensions, the only ADS theories you could embed them into would be ADS2 cross S2, and that's precisely the case where no one understands ADS CFT. Okay, no one understands what those CFT ones are supposed to be about. It's very mysterious. So it could be there are very weird theories. Wormholes are weird, and so weirdness maps to weirdness. Okay. And then a little later, Maldacena and Maus wrote a beautiful paper where they found wormhole solutions again, but these connected to different ADS spaces, okay? Not things that could be connected to each other, which was important to get the paradoxes that I was talking about. And also, in their situation, it was highly non-supersymmetric, and no one knew what the CFTs were anyway. So once again, you could say, well, maybe the CFTs have some analog of these alpha parameters. And so, in fact, the wormholes are doing something sensible. So our contribution is to realize that it's very simple to find these solutions. They exist in the maximally supersymmetric part of string theory, just compactifying the 2A or the 2B string, 32 supercharges to six flat dimensions. Okay. And six dimensions is large enough that we can embed it in ADS3 cross S3. Okay. So in the flat space region of ADS3 cross S3, and then we have... Then we can talk about what it implies for ADS CFT. Okay. But let me, I don't want to bore you too much with the technical details, but let me just tell you a little bit about what these solutions look like. So let's just imagine, in generality, that we have a theory of gravity in d dimensions. I'm working in units with the Planck scale is equal to 1, coupled to a bunch of scalar fields. And the scalar fields have a very general kinetic term with some metric gij of phi, which I can think of as a metric on the internal space of the scalar fields phi r. Okay. This is a Euclidean theory. And an important point, this is what Nemanja was referring to earlier, an important point is that, is that some of the scalar fields in this Euclidean action are going to have a peculiar sign. They'll have the opposite sign than you would naively expect. Okay? I can explain why this happens later. It's nothing fancy. It's nothing special. Exactly the same thing happens when you talk about the quantum mechanics of a particle on a circle. Okay? It just has to do with the... Let me say it another way. I'll be looking for saddle points of this theory. Okay? And in looking for saddle points... You know, it's very familiar when you look for saddle points of real integrals that the saddle points can be in the complex plane. Okay, so that's really what's going on. I have a real integral, normal continuation, but I just have to responsibly look for the saddles, and the saddles could be complex. Okay. And the net effect of that is as if I flip the kinetic term for some of the fields here.
So you're simply going to say that they're physical because they give you finite action in quantum.
Yes. So in fact, exactly as I said, exactly the same thing happens for a particle on a circle. And it's just a small technical point. It's not a big deal. So if you just, if you believe me, we can proceed to talk about slightly more interesting things. Okay. So some of these will have so this internal metric will not be have a definite signature. It'll be in general Lorentzian. There will be some minus signs for the internal metric and some plus signs for the internal metric. Okay. Then I look for an ansatz for the actual Euclidean metric that looks like what you'd expect, okay? Just something spherically symmetric, okay, where A of R goes to R, A squared of R goes to R squared as R goes to plus or minus infinity. Okay, so I want something which asymptotically opens up into flat space in the two regions. Now, unsurprisingly, it turns out that when you look at the equations of motion, these phis, which I also just take to be functions of R, just follow geodesics on their internal space, on the internal moduli space. So that's what the solution to the equation of motion ends up looking like. They just look like some Wick rotated FRW equations. And when you look at them, this just tells you that the phi I follow geodesics in the internal moduli space. So what the solutions look like depend on whether these geodesics in the internal space, because the internal space is in general Lorentzian, it depends on whether the geodesics are time-like, null, or space-like. When the geodesics are space-like, the corresponding space-time looks like it just has a big crunch somewhere. When the geodesic is null, so this is in the moduli space, okay? When the geodesic is null, the corresponding space-time looks like an extremal object. It never turns around. It looks like a d-instanton. Okay? And when the geodesic is time-like, it's a wormhole. When the geodesic is time-like, but there ends up being exactly one proviso. This is true, but if you think about it, you know, if there's too much kinetic energy, if we thought of R as time, if there's too much kinetic energy, you would still hit a singularity. So in order not to hit a singularity, you can't have too much kinetic energy. And that puts a limit on the length of the geodesic. Okay. In order to be able to find the solution, I have to be able to find a long enough geodesic in the moduli space. And it turns out that it's when d squared is bigger than 2 pi squared d minus 2 over d minus 1, something like that, in Planck units. Then there exists a wormhole solution. Everything here was in Planck units. Huh?
What's little d?
Little d, so you have to be able to find it. So if you take a purported wormhole solution, which looks like this, then the distance in the moduli space between the original point and the final point, you have to be able to find a long enough geodesic. That's d. That d is the distance in the moduli space. Okay. So it's roughly delta phi, right? You might want to call it the invariant notion of distance in field space. So this is interesting. In order to be able to find a wormhole solution, we must have transplanckian traversal in moduli space of a certain specific amount. Okay? Just like in order to be able to see gravity waves at Planck, we need to have a traversal in over Planck lengths over the Planck scale of a specific amount. Okay? Okay. Now, this way of thinking about it makes it clear why it was easy and hard to find solutions. For example, the original Giddings and Strominger case, where you just had an axion, that was a case where the metric on the moduli space, okay, this was just minus the axion squared. Okay? So it's just a line. And okay, I can make arbitrarily long length just along this line. But what happens in string theory, for the moduli spaces you get in string theory, well, so the easiest example is that of a dilaton and an axion in 2B. Okay? So if I have a dilaton and an axion, the metric is the axion squared e to the 2 phi plus d phi squared, where phi is the dilaton. And because of this funny minus sign that I told you about, there's actually a minus sign in front there. And that looks familiar. That's just the Sinner space. So what happens is that the moduli spaces you get when you get extra scalars have horizons in the moduli space. Okay? And those horizons limit the length of geodesics. Okay? So for example, in this metric, which is, I guess, opposite the metric of the De Sitter space, so I'm talking about the longest in a De Sitter space, it would be the longest space-like geodesic in De Sitter space. The horizon gives you a limit, an upper limit to the length of a space-like geodesic, which is pi. Okay, in these units is pi, and pi is never larger than root of this. Okay. So it's the presence of those horizons that made it impossible for these simple solutions to exist. Okay. So that's a little bit, this is a little mini version of the story that you'd like to get axion decay constants much bigger than the Planck scale to have inflation for gravity waves. But shoot, in string theory, it looks like simple axions, they get you around the Planck scale. So similarly here, you'd like to have a big distance in moduli space, but the simplest things actually give you a distance that's smaller than that. Well, but you can have the same bright idea as the N axions. You can say, well, maybe I can find a solution where there's sort of lots of copies of this axion and dilaton system. Okay? And the length squared just adds. Okay? So if I can just get the length squared to add, then eventually I can get more than that many. Okay? So that's what we did. Okay? And in fact, you don't have to do any algebra. You just have to know a little bit about the group theory of the moduli spaces. It turns out that if you could get 4 dilaton axion systems, 4 turns out to be enough to be able to realize this in any number of dimensions, actually. Okay? So you have to be able to find four decoupled axion-dilaton systems. And that number four, so you have to see, is it possible to fit four copies of this dilaton axion system into into the moduli space metric? Into the moduli space.
So you get an assisted wormhole?
Sorry?
You get an assisted wormhole.
Yes, that's right. It's exactly, it's N wormhole or assisted wormhole, precisely. Okay, it's exactly that same dumb idea. Okay, here the N doesn't have to be large, it's four. Okay? And anyway, I mean, this is just a technicality, but it's amusing. These moduli spaces, in the maximally supersymmetric moduli spaces in 10 dimensions, are in one-to-one correspondence with some coset. They're always in one-to-one correspondence with a coset, which in 10 dimensions is SL2R mod SO2. Okay. In 9 dimensions, it's SL3R mod SO3. In 8 dimensions, it's SL3R cross SL2R mod SO3 cross SO2. 7, it's SL5R mod SO5. And 6 is SO55 mod SO5 cross SO5. I'm writing this down because the way I remember it is it just so happens these moduli spaces are in one-to-one correspondence with little Higgs theories. it's the very basic one. This is the Schmaltz model, minimal Moos, littlest Higgs, and so it's easy for me to remember them. But the dilaton axion system, see, SL2R is the same as SO2 comma 1, which is the symmetries of De Sitter space. So that's what one plus one De Sitter space. So that's exactly the system that we had here. So to see how many of these orthogonal dilaton axion systems we can fit in, it's just a group theory question to see how many copies of SL2R we can embed into the numerator groups. Okay. And the answer is 1, 1, 2, 2, and then finally here is 4. Okay. And here it's 4 because SO55, and it's not totally obvious that it's 4, but SO55 has a natural 2, 2 cross 2-1 cross 1-2 subgroup, and 2-2 is 2-1 cross 1-2 for the same reason as SO4 is SO3 cross SO3. Okay, so this is the trick that finally allows there to exist four copies of SL2R. Okay, and that's all that was needed. So this way of thinking about it was helpful because the actual equations of motion are a little bit hairy. But this group theoretical way of thinking about it made the answer relatively clear. Okay, anyway, but this is just a complete technicality. So, maximally supersymmetric toroidal compactification, 32 supersymmetric theories, the 6 dimensions admit wormhole solutions.
What goes wrong in 5 dimensions?
If we keep going down? Oh, there are certainly solutions in lower dimensions, too. But 6 dimensions is the first place where we could easily find them. There might be ones in the higher cases as well. So what this means is that the old argument that, well, string theory is just smart enough not to produce these theories isn't true. Okay. So it does give you long-distance effective theories that give you wormhole solutions. All right? And furthermore, this is taking place in 6 dimensions where we can embed the wormholes inside ADS3 cross S3. Okay. So in ADS3 cross S3, okay, we can stick the wormholes in. So they do something here and do something there on scales short compared to the ADS radius, and they exist. Okay. But here we know the CFD. One of the most studied CFDs in the past 10 years. So it's not a weird CFD. This CFD is unique. It has no such thing as alpha parameters. So there's just a sharp contradiction with ADS CFD. ADS CFD tells you There's a unique bulk theory with these fixed asymptotics. I'm telling you what it is. Okay? It's this ABS theory. There's no room in ABS-CFT for the alpha parameters. So either ABS-CFT is wrong, or, much, much more likely, these wormholes just do not contribute. Okay? We never were guaranteed that they contribute. Even ordinary integrals, when you have ordinary integrals, they can have multiple saddle points and not every saddle point contributes. And I think the most straightforward interpretation is that these saddle points do not contribute.
So you're saying you're putting up Euclidean theory against ABS-CFT,
exactly.
And you're saying you're betting on
That's right, exactly. And I think, and there's more of a hint that this is correct, a very nice observation of Birchow et al., actually, was that these wormhole configurations correspond to something in the boundary theory that would have a negative value for the integral of f minus f dual squared.
Okay.
So, if the boundary theory is unitary and has positivity, then that seems to excise these wormhole solutions. So,
are you going to explain why it should be negative in this?
I'm not going to explain that, but I'll talk about something very related shortly, which I can explain in a totally self-consistent way.
Is there any connection to this statement that since you need to basically get the phase to be of the wrong sign to get the wormhole, if you try to analytically continue it to Lorentzian symmetry or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because no one knows exactly how, but there presumably would be a connection like that, but no one knows how to do a continuation, which
absolutely.
Is one of the problems.
Absolutely.
But I just want to make a general point, which we'll come back to just in a moment, in my last 10 minutes, which is that one is used to the statement that, well, any theory in ADS is dual to some CFT. And it's true in the sense that any theory in ADS has a boundary theory on which conformal transformations act in a well-defined way. But there's no guarantee that the boundary theory is unitary. And the requirement of unitarity on the boundary actually puts significant constraints on what is or isn't allowed in the bulk, which could be completely invisible to the bulk effective field theorist. Okay? And here is one example. Even without this, the fact that the ADS-CFT doesn't have the alpha parameters just tells you that these can't exist. But this is extra, an extra argument. So let me just recap, though, because I think now the connection to the previous things that I was saying should be clear. In order to be able to find gravity waves, we need delta phi of order m Planck. We can't do that with simple theories. Maybe we can do it by having n axions, and with n of them, we can finally get a big enough traversal so that we can have something make sense. Okay? Beautiful. This is a different situation, but they're very similar words. In order to be able to find a wormhole solution, you need to have transplanckian things. Well, simple, the simplest ingredients don't do it, but you'll try to put n of them on top of each other, and you can do it. Both statements are things that you think you can do in effective field theory, but this is a case where we can prove that it's impossible. Okay. And it's just, I think, while it doesn't prove that the other one is impossible, it does say that it's butting up against...
So if you're trying to capture the essence of what it's up against,
it's up against unitarity. It's up against having a sensible description of black holes. Ultimately, it's up against having a unitary theory.
Effective field theory is misleading us.
Effective field theory is misleading us because it's none of these problems show up at the level of
degrees of freedom or something. Dump in degrees of freedom, but don't.
It is indeed true. It is indeed true that it's also effective field theory. It's also the uncritical application of effective field theory within its domain of validity, which leads us to the black hole information paradox. So in that sense, we already know effective field theory is completely wrong. Okay, but it's not like. There were some higher dimension operators that were missing. It's not a situation where effective field theory is telling us I'm breaking down. It's a situation where effective field theory is saying everything is okay by me, and the theory is actually is breaking down. It's more like the transition from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics. Okay, so it's that's also a case where, you know, when the electron is orbiting the atom, nothing is wrong with the formalism of classical mechanics. It's just wrong. It's just wrong. Okay, and there's lots of indications that that's the way in which effective field theory also breaks down. There's something much more radical than the presence of higher dimension operators.
Our confidence in the ultimate unitary picture
right.
of a black hole
tells us a lot
lies
more.
In ADS CFT. So
right.
That's where we
right.
think we're most on track.
That's right.
And
that's
right. rejecting these things.
That's right.
So,
and I'm going to give you another example, a much simpler example of exactly the same thing. So let's go back to the species bound question. So species bound and ADS CFT. This is what I'll end with. So remember, the idea is that if you have n species, somehow the Planck scale should become large as n gets big. Somehow it should be difficult to keep some. It should be the theory should get gravity should get weak as the number of species becomes large, even though in effective field theory nothing stops you from fine tuning to keep the from fine tuning to keep the Planck scale fixed. Actually, when I was first thinking about these things, this was the first statement I tried to make precise before thinking about the weak gravity ideas. And I always had trouble because I didn't know how to sharply define what this cutoff should mean. Okay. In the case of finally weak gravity, we could make statements about the spectrum of charged particles. We could say the lightest charged particle should be lighter than something. And that's a well-defined, you know, sharply defined thing. If you're looking for inequalities, and more than squiggles. You see, the whole name of the game here is whether there's a principle that puts a sharp inequality or there's just some parametric expectation. Parametric expectations can be violated by fine-tuning. Okay, and the whole question is whether or not there's something that blocks you from tuning, because there's a reason why it's impossible. So in thinking about these things, it's important to find something that's actually sharp. You know, come up with a sharp conjecture to try to test rather than just squiggles. Okay, but actually, there is a setting in which this sort of statement can be made sharp. And that setting is ADS3. So in fact, ADS3 is a lovely place to think about all of these constraints on effective field theory, because this is a case where the dual theory is as powerful as possible. The dual conformal field theory has the most nice properties, is as constrained as possible. Okay. So two-dimensional conformal field theories are very, very rich, constrained things. Okay, so let me try to let me do two examples. So let's say I have ADS3 and I have n U1s in ADS3, n massless U1s in ADS3. All right. So this is a way of getting n degrees of freedom. Okay, but now the dual CFT really tells me something. Because each one of these U1s is dual to a boundary current. Okay. U1 current in the dual CFT. And that's a well-known fact going back to the 70s about two-dimensional conformal field theories, that when you have global symmetries around, the CFT, two-dimensional CFTs, break up into the currents plus orthogonally everything else. Each one of these currents contributes one to the central charge of the CFT. Therefore, the central charge of the CFT, two-dimensional CFT, is greater than or equal to n, because the CFT breaks up into n currents plus everything else, assuming unitarity, assuming positivity of the CFT. If there's extra stuff in the CFT with wrong sign kinetic terms, then I could get negative central charges. But assuming positivity of the CFT, that cannot happen. Okay. So C is greater than or equal to N. Let's translate this into ADS variables. C is precisely the three-dimensional Planck scale in ADS units. Okay, so there's a species bound. As I crank up N, the three-dimensional Planck scale necessarily becomes large, even though, again, Nothing stops you from an ineffective field theory from fine-tuning to keep the Planck scale fixed as you do this. But what you're screwing up, if you do that, you're making it impossible for the theory to be dual to a unitary CFD. So precisely what Bekenstein would tell you to be worried about, so you start screwing up things having to do with black hole entropy, which ultimately have to do with unitarity and positivity, precisely imposing those things on the boundary theory tells you a sharp version of the species factor. We can actually generalize this trivially. Let's say you have SUN. If you have SUN, now actually the these correspond to having some SUN global symmetry in the CFD, and the CFD is then parametrized by an integer k, which is the level, and then there is the famous Sugawara construction. The same argument tells you that the central charge, that the CFD breaks up into the SUN currents plus everything else, and the central charge for the SUN currents is this famous formula familiar to people from perturbative string theory days. Okay, there's a formula that looks like that. And so if we do this for SUN, this is like kn squared over k plus n. And if we now translate this statement, c again turns into m3l, k is 1 over g squared of the three-dimensional SUN theory in ADS units, which I guess is that. I'm writing this out because it's very pretty. So this is n squared over 1 plus n g squared l, which is n squared over 1 plus the Tuff coupling in ADS units of the bulk SUN theory. So this is a very pretty formula, because when the Tuff coupling is weak at the ADS scale, this theory is weakly coupled, and you should be able to think of it as just n squared independent degrees of freedom. And so M3L is indeed bigger than n squared. When the Tuff coupling is strong, I can't think of it necessarily as n squared independent degrees of freedom. I can't even really do a perturbative computation. But the dual theory here tells me this is always greater than or equal to n. So still, if you have any SUN theory, the Planck scale is always greater than root n, at least. The Planck is always bigger than n as n gets large. So this is another example where we see directly positivity of the dual CFD proves bulk impossibility statements.
So let me translate this into my thoughts back at the time when these species bound. So when I first heard about this work, I thought, gee, that's silly. You set up your microscopic theory and you live with whatever entropy comes out of it.
Right.
And you're saying, I think, well, secretly by measuring G Newton, we have a backdoor measurement of the number of species.
That's right.
So
that's quantum
gravity is going to link it all together.
Exactly.
And so we've already made that measurement.
Exactly.
And we know something.
Exactly.
And so
I'm saying that no
that's
theory.
Nice.
That's right.
Yeah.
It'll say that the way it'll protect itself.
So these guys were having confidence that was going to happen.
Right.
And
this proves
cool
that it happens. That's right.
Right.
And this proves that it happens. And it also, it's nice that it proves that what you need for it to happen is exactly what they were trying to preserve, which was unitarity.
Yeah.
Okay. So we see that very, very explicitly.
Nima, could you just say once more where that top formula there came from?
Oh, I'm just using the ADS CFD dictionary. So the ADS CFD dictionary tells you to relate the central charge of the CFD to the Planck, to the bulk Planck scale in ADS units, and this level K is related to the gauge coupling of the U1 and the bulk in ADS units again. Okay. So this is totally trivial. What I'm telling you, there's really, it's just the only novelty here is just doing it. And the reason this hasn't been commented on before is that people studying these ADS string theories are usually studying it in string theory, where these things just happen automatically, so you don't comment on them. Okay, but this is saying just more generally, this is a way of just knowing that unitarity of the boundary, having a manifest unitary evolution, this in this case just proves various impossibility statements in the bulk. Well, okay, so time is late, so I don't have time to tell you about. So then there's a whole bunch of other things you can do in three dimensions. There's a lot of other, there's statements like, the statement that gravity breaks all global symmetries is something you can probe directly here, for example. Other arguments against the existence of wormholes is something that you can explicitly argue for in this example. But I think I'm running out of time. I think I probably am out of time. So maybe I'll just end there, and if anyone's interested, I can tell you about some of the other things. But I just want to conclude by saying that maybe the hope that there's a unique theory of there's unique vacuum has been dashed, but there is actually a new opportunity. there might be simple general things about combining quantum mechanics and gravity that we still don't know, and simple understanding for what is and isn't allowed that we still don't know, and it's not irrelevant for interesting questions, as I said right at the start. You know, for how surprised we should be, whether we should expect to see gravity waves or not, is precisely such a question, which is I think still up in the air. A lot of these arguments seem to me to suggest that we won't see them. But I can't prove it. I still can't prove it yet. Right. Huh?
To look.
Definitely all the more reason to look. And as I said, it would shock me for these reasons. But it's still not airtight that it can't happen. So they're really interesting long distance theories that are up for grabs. And the landscape can in this sense be thought of as data. You know, that there's a lot we know. There's at least a lot of examples we know of what consistent theories look like. So there is a, if one has some general picture for what you're looking for, and if you can make sharp conjectures about them, they can be checked. Okay, so there's a, and particularly in 2+1 dimensions, in ADS3, I think there's a lot that can be done with just exploiting more sophisticated properties of the boundary theory to learn even more special things about the bulk theory. I should say that one of the reasons I got also interested in ADS3, because I have no time to talk about it, is that our own, we say, why the hell should we care about ADS3? Well, our own world, the standard model coupled to gravity, turns out to have a vacuum, which is ADS3. Yeah. So there is a vacuum of our universe where you compactify one of the circles, you know, the z direction on a circle, and it gets stabilized by Casimir energies to have a size of about 3 microns. And that world is ADS3. So there's a very, very close cousin of our universe. Our universe has an empty de Sitter space vacuum. There is some two-dimensional conformal field theory that describes the standard model in that vacuum. So, you know, trying to understand things about ADS3 is not completely divorced from trying to understand things about our world, because in particular, all of particle physics is identical in that world as to ours. Because it turns out the size of the circle is big. It's like 2 microns, 3 microns or so. But still the experimental thing to wait for is gravity waves. I think if we don't see them, it'll be consistent with the picture that these impossibility things mean something. If we do see them, I think it'll throw a number of us for a loop. And I think we're awaiting it with a bated breath. So thanks a lot.
So Andy or somebody like that, when are we likely to know whether there are any gravity waves at some
Lloyd's probably
level.
The best one. This is supposed to launch, and Lloyd's not here, right? It's launch in 08, I think. I don't know how much that's slipping, and then
Give it probably.
Yeah.
Planck is, some people say that Planck actually can't quite decisively prove there is this other thing called.
Oh, then that's a bit of a way.
The pipeline, that's like 10 year, maybe more, something like that.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. Depends on how lucky you are, okay? You know, or unlucky, depending on the point of view, right?
You know,
sure.
Lifetime. Yeah, we should make it happen. Make sure
oh, yeah. No, I think, but Planck will do a factor of 5.
Could
right.
be.
Yeah. So that's what I was talking about, literally, right? So if Planck sees something, then in that direction at least, if Planck sees something,
then I don't think it has room to see something.
So what epsilon will Planck probe?
10^-2, I think.
10^-2.
I mean,
Planck needs to see. Planck needs it to be basically, roughly speaking, a few percent of the scalar perturbations to
right.
be able to see.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's point
and that's
epsilon.
That's something
right.
like yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
Okay.
About 10^-2.
In other words, you've got to be, you know, the scalar inflation needs to be about 10 to the 14 GeV, inflation needs to be roughly relatively short, and then chances are you can see a signal. And that's like, you know, the best opportunity for observation.
And I should say, you know, it's only this delta five order in Planck. Nothing would stop some low energy effective theory just to tune and accidentally cancel epsilon and eta. You know, nothing is wrong with that. Everything happening at sub-Planckian vats, there's nothing against inflation directly.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Planckian traversal
gravity.
Right.
It's what you're basically saying is this sort of large field inflation,
right.
chaotic inflation.
Right. And of course, it's very interesting that that's precisely at the moment the most preferred thing.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So
exactly.
This is why I wouldn't be shocked if we actually see gravity waves, and then we really have to understand. Because none of this is airtight. Anyway, I don't need to say it again. It's clear that seeing gravity waves is right on the edge of something, right? That,
but it sounds like a lot of the ADS CFT is riding on this, right? Is that fair?
Everything I've said has been on, it's not directly impinged on that question.
Right.
It's just been very, very similar sounding questions
right.
where you'd
right.
say very, very similar sounding words and you get the wrong answer.
But would you start
right.
worrying about ASCFT if you saw this?
I wouldn't worry about ASCFT, but I would think that there was.
It's tricky how it relates to our world or something.
Well, no, I mean, I would just think that there's something. There's something we don't understand. I mean, these inflation people say, oh, this is all fine. We have a theory with 100 axions, and there's some accidental cancellation, and it works. Okay, but of course they can't do a systematic computation. Okay, they're just relying on the fact that everyone agrees that it doesn't work parametrically.
With some leading order.
Okay, so they do some leading order. Now, if there's a principle why it can't happen. Which sounds conspiratorial until you see examples like this,
yeah.
right? If there's a principle that it can't happen, then it would tell you that the corrections will be big. You know, you're just estimating that everything's going to be okay, but no, the corrections are going to be big. The corrections that you haven't computed are going to be big. Okay? So, So you see, it already gives one a little bit of pause that you can't fine tune everything. Just because you think, it's only a fine-tuning problem, big deal, 10 of the zillion vacua, surely it can fine-tune. You cannot fine-tune some things.
I mean,
okay?
Just naively, by some brute force, if I wanted to tune M1 so that I keep inflation.
Right.
That the problem is that it seems like in the absence of the light modes,
right.
I need to have negative one.
Of course, that's right. But
sure,
you say that doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
That's right.
Sure.
That's right. Of course.
Sure.
That's already a hint that this should have something to do with the unit theory. I should say there are other theories that I think are much more solidly excluded. I mean, or in conflict with standard ideas. Things like the DGB model, for example, are at much more basic level, in sharp conflict with very basic things that we expect, at least from string theory. Things like absence of superluminality and things like that. And that's, again, these are general principles that if they're violated, would screw up horizon thermodynamics. If they're not violated, you know, don't. And, of course, it's an experimental question if they're violated. I mean, so it doesn't say the theory's wrong, but it puts theories in categories, you know, things that broadly agree with conservative things that we know and things that do not. So it either makes them much less likely or much more exciting, depending on your point of view.
What about F of R modifications? Is that
let's not even talk about that. These are really, really dumb theories.
Okay.
I mean, they're exactly equivalent to adding a scalar field. So they're not worth talking about.
Okay.
They're not modifying anything in a way that wasn't done by Brands and Dickey many, many years ago. So,
amen to that.
Any more questions? Let's thank Liam again.
Thank you.